Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 24th of August 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, Gareth James, and Nick from Partially Obstructed View. We're now going to talk about Dogfight, which is a musical at the Southwark Playhouse. This is written by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul with a book by Peter Duchan. It is based on a 1991 film by Nancy Savoca, which starred River Phoenix and Lily Taylor. Gareth, could you tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it?
Well, it would be hard to find a more unlikely premise for a musical, I think, because it's about a bunch of Marines who are on a bender the night before they get deployed in Vietnam. So we're set in the early 60s in San Francisco. And they seek out girls for their last night party. And it takes us a while to realize that this is more than just seeking out a girl to be with. This is a bit of a cruel game, which I won't sort of say more about. And the first part of the show is very much that. They're seeking out the girls and they're going to the party and then their strategy gets rumbled. And then we find that the leading man sort of rescues the situation by sort of taking his girl out for a romantic dinner, although he's got so much pent-up anger it's quite hard for him to have such a thing as a romantic dinner. But he leaves and goes to war and leaves behind his address in the hope that he will keep in touch with Rose, and Rose will keep in touch with him, more to the point. And the show is framed by two scenes 4 years later when they've come back, although that's not, I don't think, made clear enough in this production. But in the second and the final scene, we see, you know, the returning Marine, and we see how he's received both at a political level and indeed at a personal level. I don't think it's a great show. I don't think it's a great sort of, particularly the book, I think, but it does have a really good score, which did kind of surprise me. And I think that's the key to this. It's actually got some very good songs and very good music. But what you can't deny is that it gets the production to die for, really, I think. You know, it is just a love story, or not a lot more than a love story, but this score is good. It's beautifully played by a six-piece band, which has got sort of cello, bass and violin, so it's not a sort of rock sound, with musical directors George Dyer. And the Marines, there are sort of six Marines who, when they're singing together as a chorus, make a great sound. And Jamie Moscato, who plays this kind of edgy lead character, Eddie, is very, very good indeed. But the performance of the show for me is a young girl called Laura Jane Matthewson, who's, believe it or not, making her professional debut. I did actually see her in a sort of student musical at the Royal Academy of Music, but this is just a very, very good acting and singing performance. She does have a beautiful, beautiful voice. But she also, you know, really does act this role, which kind of, you know, she has to take this sort of naive girl and become a bit feisty and then sort of almost turn into a woman before your eyes, really. So a superb performance. You know, not taking away anything from some of the others. There's a lovely, there's a prostitute called Marcy, who's played brilliantly by Rebecca Traherne, again, with a particularly good singing voice. And then there's Amanda Ninahan, who we saw and raved about in Carousel just a matter of weeks ago, who's kind of hot-footed it from Dalston down to Southwark to do another lovely little cameo performance as Rose's mother, and indeed another part as well, really. So again, great casting. The producer here, Daniel Torrento, has another one of those people who has a knack of great cast, and she's done it again here. It's staged very much like in The Heights, which was, I think, the last musical in this bigger space at Southwark Playhouse. So it's audience on three sides and band and entrances on the fourth side. So it's a very sort of simple staging. The choreography is excellent. The stage, you know, the direction is excellent. And I just thought it just kind of swept me away again, not because of the story or the music, but because of the talent and the creativity on show. So I saw the night before the press night, and it was certainly, apart from maybe a few glitches in the sound, absolutely ready for the press night. I think, John, you actually were the night after the press night.
No, I was at the press night.
Oh, right.
And yes, you're right, the sound is distinctly muddy, and that was my complaint in The Heights as well. It needs fixing, and it matters very much whether you sit on the side, because it's a three-sided set. It matters very much whether you sit on, or which side you sit on, and how far back you sit, and some people heard perfectly clearly, and some of us were just getting this distorted. And it's the same. It was the same problem at In the Heights, and I think it's something that, along with the air conditioning, probably needs fixing quite urgently at Southwark Playhouse. Now, having said that, I thought this was a brilliant show, both in its concept and in its resolution. It was interesting that the night I went, all the creatives were there, Pasek and I can't remember the other lyricist's name, but particularly Jamie Duchan, I don't quite know how you pronounce his surname. I could see him, he wasn't very far from me, leaning forward in his seat and visibly enjoying this elevation of the play. And I think that the book probably got better treatment here than it maybe did in its off-Broadway incarnation. I think it's really clever the way this musical turns from a sort of studly, braggadocio portrayal of young men eager and ready for the adventure of war, particularly in this 100th anniversary of the First World War, where we're seeing a lot of television visual about young men in the same sort of excited state going abroad to do what they think is a valuable job. And how it pivots from this sort of, as I say, slightly studly musical to something very sweet and not traditional musical theatre syrupy sweet, but just the kind of nice narrative that you actually care about the outcome of the two central characters. That is, as Gareth says, you know, underpinned by two fantastic performances. Jamie Muscata, I think I've only seen when he was a kind of ancillary character in Spring Awakening at the Lyric Hammersmith. But Laura Jane Matthewson is new to me, and wow, you know, this woman is going to be huge. She really has a great voice for characterization. I mean, she has a naturally excellent singing voice, but the way she bends it around this big variety of songs is excellent. And that's another thing that I really enjoyed, that the music sort of defines genre. It's not, I thought it might have been a score which was mostly sort of popish tunes from the period in the early 70s when these guys were going away. But it isn't. There's some crooning, there's some belting, there's a bit of acoustic with a guitar, there's a couple of poignant ballads, there's a very martial sort of sextet when the guys are storming around. It's this wonderful bridge, really, between, you know, it reminded me at first, because it's three young heroes and they've only got their last night, they've got their last day, they're in San Francisco. I thought, oh God, it's borrowed completely from On the Town. It's the three sailors. And whereas in 1936, you know, they were out to kiss a girl for the first time, here they want to do very much more. And in fact, do it. It's very graphic. It's you see loss of virginity, you see something in a whorehouse. It's well done from that point of view. It's not tasteless, but it's quite graphic. But then it transitions into a bit of Miss Saigon. Only it's better than Miss Saigon in many ways, because it's not as underlit and musically dreadful as the current production at Drury Lane. So I really think it's very good. And yes, of course, you know, well done, Southwark Playhouse. It's yet another notch on that terrific gun belt for Daniel Taranto, following In the Heights and Titanic. It seems they can do no wrong. And they have certainly eclipsed, in my opinion, the Union in terms of being a crucible of really good musical theatre production. And I'd say they're the new Meunier. As the Meunier becomes more and more mainstream, you know, this is... It's a great gift, and someone is doing a huge amount of research to find these off-Broadway musicals and bring them to London in sometimes a better incarnation than they may have enjoyed with more money in the States. So very much recommended. I know no one who's seen this who wasn't somewhat moved by it, and that's another real test, particularly of slightly cynical new media critics. There were 55 of us at press night. That's a fairly hefty chunk of the audience, but there were definitely people who were affected by the show. So strong performances throughout, a really interesting story that you'll want to follow, and some belting singing and some very interesting music. You know, there is nothing not to like in this.
Interesting that it's well received by the mainstream critics, though. You know, Time Out, I don't think the Standards even reviewed it. Time Out were very, very iffy about it. And I think one or two of the other press reviews have been very much the same. So it's been an interesting new versus old critical reception, I'd say.
Yes, I agree. I've read a couple of reviews. There was quite a nasty one on whatsonstage.com.
Yes.
And Miss Mountford from the Evening Standard didn't enjoy it, but then she doesn't enjoy much. No, I would say most critics whose opinion I appreciate seem to have plenty of good things to say about it, but certainly from an audience point of view, it's a really enjoyable, interesting show, and it's out of the ordinary, it's out of the mould, I think is the best thing you can say about it.
I think the stage.com was fascinating because she likened it to Spring Awakening, and I sent her a message saying, what, you mean the Spring Awakening, that's the late 19th century German story of sexual repression? Because I thought it was just preposterous that you could say this was the son of Spring Awakening. But there you go. Critics will be critics.
That's their job.
We're now going to talk about Epstein at Leicester Square Theatre. This is a story of Brian Epstein, who was the manager of the Beatles and the man who essentially discovered them, and really, but more than that, he popularized them and made everybody pay attention to them. In this play, which is a two-hander, written by Andrew Sherlock and directed by Jen Hayes, we have an encounter between Brian Epstein in 1967, possibly not long before he died, and a young man who's simply referred to and refers to himself when he addresses the audience as this boy or that boy, which is I didn't quite get the allusion at first. I think it's a Beatles song, but it's not a Beatles song I know that well. It looks at first as if it's some kind of pickup, that Brian Epstein's picked him up in a bar, that something like that's going to go on. But what really transpires is that this boy is trying to find out about who the real Brian Epstein is. He's a fellow Liverpudlian, and also is trying to find out for various reasons. I don't really want to give away the reasons why he's trying to find out more about Brian Epstein, but it's a fairly standard thing, and you can probably guess at what that is. But what we get is a very interesting portrait of him, and this man who has created a mythology about himself, has written his own biography or autobiography or co-written it, and has given a story which he knows isn't entirely accurate, and he knows it's not the real him, because he's having to hide so much. I mean, not just his homosexuality, not just Epstein's homosexuality, but also just about what he is and how good he is at business and things like that, and his real feelings. It's really, I think, a very strong performance by Andrew Lansell as Brian Epstein. He really captures the arrogance and, well, not so much arrogance, I think, but a sort of that kind of corporate speak that he's having to hide behind, the very smooth, insouciant impresario. It's almost like a Svengali. That is the image he's got of himself, as this sort of master of finding new talent and promoting it. But it is a front. He's hiding behind it. He's hiding behind everything. And I think Andrew Lansell portrays that very well. You've also got Will Finlayson as the young man who, is really there just to put questions. But overall, I think it's a very effective play and absolutely fascinating. I'm not sure that it's the first time actually I've ever been to the Leicester Square Theatre, and I'm not entirely certain that it was it suited the play. There's very, very good legroom in that theatre, which is good, but it does mean that if you're sitting a few rows back, you feel as if you're sitting much further back than you would in a more cramped and a more intimate theatre. And I think this needs a slightly more intimate space. There's too much room at the sides in the Leicester Square Theatre, and I would have quite liked it somewhere where I felt more intimate and more engaged. And also on the night I went, it was rather undeservedly not that full. So that was a bit of a disappointment. What do you think about it, Gareth?
Well, I will resist giving you my version of This Boy, which is a Beatles song, which is why it has that title. I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, this is the soundtrack of my life, this whole kind of period, really, and therefore I kind of soak up any sort of Beatles biographical stuff. But what's interesting about this, of course, is that the Beatles are offstage characters, and what we're getting now is we're getting an interesting perspective on their manager. And what we often forget is that he grew up as well during the same period, because when the Beatles started, he was just, you know, running a record shop that his dad owned. And so he had this journey that the Beatles also had. But he was, you know, he was pivotal to 60s music, not just the Beatles, but he also discovered and managed a lot of other people as well, some of which we wish he hadn't and some of which we're happy he did. And the whole kind of Merseybeat thing, I think, is very much down to Epstein. What was most striking about this is that my memories of Epstein is as a much older man than the Beatles themselves. And what was kind of striking about this is the realization that he actually died at 32. And this takes place, you know, just before he dies. So, in fact, he was in his late 20s for the sort of heyday of the Beatles. And yet, when you kind of look at them and look at him, you think, you know, he's this much older kind of father figure, really. And that was just something that really struck me in Andrew Sherlock's play. I think it's good, I think, at giving us, you know, the psychological makeup of the man and telling us about the man. I think some things about it are a bit contrived. I didn't really, the sort of this boy talking direct to the audience didn't completely work for me, particularly because they peppered it too much with cheesy references and song titles and lyrics. So that didn't entirely work for me. And there's a sort of Epstein actually flip-flops a lot during the play between trust and suspicion. And I thought that was maybe a touch overplayed, not by the actor, but by the writing. But it's a very, very interesting, new perspective on that period. I think it is extremely well performed by Andrew Lancel and Will Finlayson. And Andrew Lancel's happens to have a resemblance to Epstein, which kind of helps. He's also another refugee from Coronation Street, by the way. And Will Finlayson is much newer to the stage, and I think it's an extremely good early performance for someone whose career I suspect is going to go places. It's quite simply staged in a living room, but they project onto the walls. Not all the time, but occasionally, and that kind of animates the play a little bit. But I do agree with you, it's probably in too big a theatre. I think it would fare well in somewhere like the Donmar or the Southwark Play, as we just talked about, or the Bush, or, you know, somewhere a bit smaller. But it didn't detract for me, because I was sitting in the middle quite close to the front, so I was able to kind of, you know, sort of get into it, really. There is music in it, but it's just illustrative, really. It's not, it doesn't detract from the narrative, it's just there in the background. I thought it was, what was nice about, I mean, it's nice it's come to London, I think, but what was particularly nice, I thought, is that it was the play that opened a Liverpool theatre that was refurbished and renamed the Epstein Theatre. So I thought it was great that, A, they've given a theatre his name so that, you know, he's not in the background going forward, and great that they took this play and used that as their debut production. So I would recommend it. I mean, particularly for, you know, for Beatles fans or people of a certain age, which indeed most of the audience like me were. But I think it's something I would absolutely recommend going to. And there are lots of younger people that are intrigued and interested by this period. So I wouldn't, you know, it's not just for people who live through it. It's for, you know, for people who are interested by it, I think.
So, John, what did you think about Epstein?
Well, a little bit like Gareth, I think it ought to have been the soundtrack of my life. I was barely a teenager, I suppose, when the Beatles came to prominence, but their music did sort of inform some of my later teenage years. And I knew a little bit about Brian Epstein by reputation. I must have seen him interviewed on television. So I enjoyed the story, and I felt kind of slightly more informed about him by the end of the piece than I did at the beginning. I didn't realise he was quite such a self-destructive character. And I really thought that Andrew Lancel brought that to life. What I didn't think he did very well was to capture the voice. You know, like my good self, Epstein is a northern lad who had elocution lessons. But I thought that there was plenty of material available online which shows what Epstein sounded like, and Andrew Lancel wasn't there. In fact, there was one moment when I thought he must have read the brief wrong and he was actually doing Brian Sewell rather than Brian Epstein, because his voice was so strangulated and so overfruited that I think that could that could be worked on. I also liked the performance of Wilf Innocen as the boy and sundry other characters, but I questioned the structure of the play with having only one person do this, and what purpose he served other than just to sort of flesh out what could otherwise have been a monologue. I like some of the tensions in the scripting and in the staging. When there's a bit of violence, it erupts and it feels more real than it does when they're just kind of flopping about on a sofa and drinking too much and talking to each other. I do agree that the staging in Leicester Square felt wrong because you didn't appreciate necessarily the back projections. Certainly from where I was sitting, I was sort of just to the side on the second row. They weren't very clear. And I think what the play doesn't know is whether it is a sort of Beatles tribute act, in which case there ought to be a lot more visual and a lot more music, or whether it's just a very, very intimate duologue, in which case it probably needs a more intimate setting. So I'm sure it'll be dragged out again or revived again with other opportunities, and maybe for an audience that knows nothing about the Merseybeat generation, it'll be quite illuminating.
We're now going to talk about A Picture of John Gray, which is a new play by C.J. Willman at the Old Red Lion. It concerns John Gray, a poet who was a particular friend of Oscar Wilde for a time, and also one or two other people from Oscar Wilde's life, though not Oscar Wilde himself, although they are expecting him to turn up at a party at one stage. Paul, could you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
Well, the Picture of John Gray, which is currently playing at the Old Red Lion Theatre, the way I interpret it is it's trying to reimagine the period around which Oscar Wilde was having an intense love affair with a young man who then became the inspiration for the picture of Dorian Gray. So you have, while you don't have Oscar Wilde who appears in the piece, you have a lot of his contemporaries. And John Gray is a young artist who aspires to be a poet, and he's met Wilde at some point and then become the subject of the book. And the circle in which Oscar Wilde moves around is all very talking about, well, what does this mean and so forth, particularly since Oscar Wilde is now moving towards another young man who becomes the subject of Oscar Wilde's downfall eventually. But that's not the focus of this piece. The piece is actually where John Gray meets Rafalovich, who is also a writer and critic at the time, and how they eventually become lovers. But during the period of which Oscar Wilde's trial takes place and the circles in which they move, sort of the impact on the other artists at the time. And actually, I think what's interesting about this piece is how it imagines this, and this is a play written by C.J. Willman, trying to reimagine how a scandal of this magnitude then impacts the circle of artists and friends and hangers-on that might be in Oscar Wilde's circle at that time. I think the interesting thing also is that something that's probably I was not familiar with, that John Gray actually then decides that he's not really an artist. He has a higher calling, which is a spiritual calling, and becomes a priest. And then Rafalovich, not only he supports him while he's becoming a priest, but then he actually follows him to Scotland, where he takes up a position at a chapel, and they basically live out the rest of their lives. And I think it's quite an interesting story when you actually look at gay men living in a different period. One of the things that I'd seen the same week I saw this was a musical that an attempted musicalization of Mussolini's persecution of homosexuals. And what I felt was it didn't really capture the time, the place, or the period, or the type of lifestyles that people would have been living. But I think this one, actually, by contrast, the picture of John Gray actually really starts to
make some thought-provoking ideas about what it was to be a gay man living in the Victorian period and how you would actually get around society and so forth. So I think, not without having some reservations about the piece, and I'm sure some of the other commenters on today's podcast will talk about those, I think what really I found intriguing in this piece was the writing and how it actually successfully, in my mind, recreated a different period in which gay men existed and how they got by in existing.
Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, for me, what was interesting on this was, obviously, like Paul says, there's no appearance, actually, by Oscar Wilde, and it is really an attempt to look at sort of the forgotten person in his story, who was John Gray. But I think the presence of Oscar Wilde is interesting in this way, that the lives of these people are, they're really kind of at the mercy of how popular he is. And so you see at the start that all this sort of social circle of his are kind of really living the high life and very popular because they are friends with him. And then, of course, with the downfall of Oscar Wilde, their fortunes kind of fall without having any kind of direct contribution to any of it. So I think that is interesting, and I agree that it's quite fascinating to see the amount of sort of hiding in plain sight that's going on between sort of the Charleses, who are the couple who live together, and they're a pair of artists, and they sort of balance being living together and having this circle of friends who always enjoys hanging out at their house, the Vale. With also having a certain sort of reticence towards making it too obvious in public exactly what their relationship is. And I think that's possibly something that they could get away with a lot more before the trial of Oscar Wilde. And I think generally people could have got away with more, because I do get the feeling that there was sort of this hiding in plain sight thing, this thing of kind of being able to be quite flamboyant and obvious, so long as you didn't kind of actually mention exactly what was going on, and people didn't really think too much either way about it. The play itself, I found it's a little bit gentle, really, to make a huge amount of impact, but it's nicely written. It's not anything too special, but it's a decent enough little story, although again I think not everyone will agree.
So John, what do you think?
Obviously, I'm not everyone in this case. I really want to completely demolish it, because I do think it's a very good idea for a story. I did know something about the life of John Gray before I went to it. But I'm interested that everyone thinks this is such a good recreation of mores and behaviours and manners in the 1890s, because that is where I disagree. Paul said that he'd been to it on the back of the play about Mussolini's persecuted homosexuals on the island of San Mineo at Fiesole. I saw it on the back, so to speak, of my night with Reg, and the similarities struck me as really kind of strong, because here also you have a central character who never appears. Oscar Wilde never comes on stage in the same way that Reg is not apparent in My Night with Reg. And you have what I thought were gay characters seen through contemporary sensibilities. I did not see this as an accurate portrayal of what life was like for gay men in the 1890s. I thought that the writer was applying his own view of how people should or might behave nowadays, rather than in an era when it was vital to conceal your sexuality. And I thought this could have been the cast of My Night with Reg, because you've got the old married couple, you've got the boastful one, you've got the conflicted one, you've got the one that everyone wants to sleep with. And in Bosie, you've got the one that everyone has slept with. So I didn't really get... And also, the other reason I got quite annoyed with the play, because of the lazy production values. There are lots and lots of anachronisms, both in the script and in the design and production, that really got on my nerves. You know, there's a suitcase on stage with an airline label on it. There are cans of emulsion paint scattered about the set. The costumes are modern men's hire department wedding attire instead of anything that looks like it might have been worn before the turn of the last century. That's That's lazy, as is the use of... There are quite a lot of anachronistic phrases in the script, one of which I had to look up because I just sort of sat up with a bolt when somebody said, I didn't want to hassle Oscar Wilde. And I thought, hassle? That can't be a 19th century word. And it isn't. It didn't appear until the mid-1950s. So that's lazy, that's bad, that's not great writing. But it doesn't stop it being a good concept. And I think with some significant re-editing, and I think quite a bit of recasting, this play might have a longer life. Nobody's said anything so far about the performances. And whilst I think Patrick Walsh McBride playing John Gray, he had all the gentleness and all the sensitivity of the soul of a poet. I thought he did that quite well. Two things really stand in his way. One is, although John Gray is meant to be a man of about 27 who looks younger, he doesn't look 13, which is what Patrick Walsh McBride does. And the other thing about him is he is very famously a blonde. Quite an unusual, striking pale blonde, and McBride is has brown hair, which that just seems a silly piece of casting, really. The actual blonde in the cast, Tom Cox, has I think he had a lot of fun with playing Bosie, and I quite liked him, although you're probably not meant to like Bosie very much. And then Christopher Tester, who is Marc-Andre Rafalovich. Interesting, he looks a little bit like Rafalovich, so that's probably why he was chosen for the part. And I thought he had, a good stab at the performance, although, you know, accents always upset me when they're not very right. And he's meant to be French, but he sounds like Anthony Valentine in Colditz playing the German major. I'm sorry, it just didn't really feel right for me. Anyway, a good play, an interesting play that I think needs a bit of fixing before it could have an extended life. But I wish it well, and I hope it does.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.